Do you want a beautiful lawn? Enter True Green, the easiest way to get a great lawn. Just water and mow and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and more. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. And they have a verified best price, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com, TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people. Guaranteed.
Every team, every topic, everywhere. This is Believe.
Can you believe this?
Oh, I don't know. Say it with your chest.
Looking to push tempo here, the Pelicans.
He'll get there. Bunny hops into a bucket.
Hold that follow through.
He posed.
That's right.
This is what takes you to another level.
What the Pell is up, everybody? This is Believe in the New Orleans Pelicans, and I'm your host, Elliot Clough. On today's podcast, before we even start, I apologize for getting this to you on Tuesday. The plan was to get it to you Monday, but on vacation, you know, stuff happens. So on today's podcast, we have Chris Connor of the Bird Rights rejoining the podcast, our first rejoining guest ever. So very excited to have Chris back on today's show. Chris and I talk about the current state of things in the NBA, whether or not we think it is a good idea for the season to restart for a lot of different reasons. In terms of player health and the spread of the coronavirus, this second wave that we're currently in, the strength of schedule for the Pelicans, and much, much more in terms of NBA conversation. But we also give you a little bit of a surprise piece at the end, not necessarily talking about the Pelicans or even basketball. So stick around for that. Chris and I had a lot of fun on today's podcast, so not one that you want to miss. So here is my conversation with Chris Connor of the Bird Rights. All right, Pelicans fans, so like you heard in that intro, we have got the man, the myth, the legend, Chris Connor on today's podcast. This man has been on every single Pelicans podcast possible, I think. That was a lot of P's in a row. But yeah, we got Chris Connor on the show from the Bird Rights and SB Nation. Very excited to have him on today. Chris, how you doing, man?
Man, I'm doing as good as one can right now with everything that's going on, man. You know, trying to excite myself up for some basketball upcoming, and happy to be on the show, man. You know, I've been, you know, as you mentioned before, I've been kind of running around this thing for a while now. These past 2 weeks, everybody been, you know, making me feel like I'm more popular than I really am. So, you know, so yeah, man, I'm happy to be on, man, and glad you have me.
Yeah, man, you've been killing it. You've been on some of the big podcasts too, and yeah, we're happy to have you on again. The first returning Pelicans guest that we've ever had, so you should be honored, I think.
man, I definitely appreciate it.
Yeah. So, to get right into it, it is official. We have a schedule and everything for the remainder of the NBA season. And we've had some discussion in the Bird Rights group, and some of the guys have sounded off on their own personal Twitter pages. So, do you think it's a good idea to go forward with the season amid what is basically a spike in, I guess you could say, a second wave, or just a continuation of this first wave of COVID? What are your thoughts?
No, I think it's a terrible idea. But, I mean, like we've been talking about throughout this whole process, we knew that the NBA would do whatever they had to do to preserve what they feel like is their future financially and as a league going forward. And you know, I don't think any of us should to necessarily be surprised when a corporation does something like this. And, yeah, I mean, personally, I can't envision this going well. You know, I have so many questions from a health perspective, from a, you know, and I get the bubble aspect of things and what it's supposed to do. But even then, it's so many different, you know, for example, with the Disney employees, with, you know, some of them not having to stay within the bubble, how it's going to be policed. I, you know, you watch some of these other sports and these guys that are getting together, and whether it be, you know, we saw in baseball and soccer, pretty much all of the other sports that are starting to come together, or any of them that have restarted on any, even if it's a slower basis, they've had some type of corona issue at some point where a player's gotten in. And, you know, my worry is that some prominent player, an important player to what we want these playoffs to be, you know, what if he ends up getting it? You know, what's the odds of some type of scandal or cover-up that happens? Or if that player has to sit out for 10 to 14 days in that team, whether, let's say, it's a Milwaukee or something happens to Giannis or LeBron in L.A., that team is pretty much eliminated, or their long-term postseason hopes are done for. I feel like we still have more questions than answers, and it just feels like there are so many things that can go wrong. There's so many more reasons to worry with right now, with everything that's going on with the virus that we still haven't figured out, that we're still trying to learn about. I'm not comfortable with it, but I can also understand why it's being done.
Honestly, man, it's so difficult. I mean, we're not going to be exposed to anything. We're going to be in the safety of our homes or with family and stuff. But it's so difficult from this vantage point that we're both in as members of the media that, you know, I mean, and it's tough for just anyone who's a fan as an adult, because you can be biased because we want basketball to come back. I interacted with some of our friends over at Pro Pels Talk, Justin Napoli, and we're both very excited and ready to go. But at the same time, you have to factor in the human part. These are humans, and they're susceptible to this virus. I mean, you mentioned the Stars. Nikola Jokic has already been diagnosed.
Exactly. That's just what we know of so far. I mean, you know, we got to remember that at some point we saw that, there were two LA Laker players that when Corona initially hit and players were reporting back to their teams for testing, we had players that were diagnosed that, you know, we didn't end up, you know, receiving names. And of course it's a private matter, but all these things eventually come out. Jokic is a wonderful example. He's a star player. And this is, I mean, we have so many other players outside of Jokic that have been diagnosed that are gonna have to play a role in this thing as we go along. And we don't know between now and these teams meeting, you know, these teams getting together in the end of July, who else is gonna pop up. I just don't see how this thing can go smoothly for the period of time that you're trying to run it. I think that with everything considered, a bubble is a good idea, but not the way in which they are running it, and not the way in which, you know, it feels like it's just at a time in which not many sports organizations or not many sports leagues should be up and running right now. We got people like Rudy Gobert mentioning that he still isn't fully recovered from coronavirus, and his positive test came back in mid March when the league was originally suspended. You have NFL players like Von Miller, who, you know, he mentioned that it took him over 3 weeks for him to fully recover. The long term damage that it can do to a person's lungs that we've seen, it's so many questions involved, and it's just such a scary outlook that it's just not something I'd be willing to risk. And like I said, man, it really scares me going forward for the safety and the health of these guys.
And you mentioned, what if a superstar gets sick? Well, what if a whole team gets sick? Because this is one of the most transmissible viruses that I'm aware of. And we've already seen, I believe that it was the Kings that had four players already with the virus. Like, what do we do if the entire Suns roster gets sick? The entire Lakers or Clippers roster gets sick? Are they effectively done? What if they can't compete?
I mean, again, as I say when we first started talking about it here, there are so many questions in which you could take, and we don't have enough time to bring up every single question or alternative world that we could be living in due to a player's injury or due to a player's injury due to a player's sickness. Outside of that, what about a player's family? You know, it's just with everything that's going on, this was something in which we felt like as a nation that we had a firm grasp on, and we were closer to a point of a vaccine. I think that there might be something that, you know, we could look at and say, all right, well, maybe the risk can outdo the reward. I don't think we're there. I don't think we're there. And I mean, with a second wave right around the corner in October, we don't know from a health perspective what type of situation we're putting these players in. And with a lack of organization, and it kind of feels like the NBA is kind of, they're kind of filling in things as they go. And I don't think you can play with someone's health in a situation like this where it's so many different questions and just so many not enough answers. We're talking life and death for some people. For some people that could be involved here. We're talking about guys that may not ever fully recover. And sure, whether it could be a situation where we're talking players not only risking short-term health in their career and their career, but long-term. I get the feeling that you're going to have a situation that once this thing pops off, you're going to have a few players that midway in just say, you know what, I can't do this. I'm having second thoughts. So like I said, Elliot, man, we haven't even started to begin to get into the depths of some of these things, man. I know we're happy, we're excited that the basketball is back in some way or form. Baseball is on its way back, and we know that the football is going to continue to roll on. But it's hard. It's hard for me to fully dive in when we know what's at risk.
Scary, scary stuff. And these are players and teams that we hold dear to our hearts too. And that's just it. It's scary, scary times that we're living in, whether or not you're talking about sports. But now that we've got the concerning, sad stuff out of the way, the NBA season's happening whether we like it or not. Now we got the schedule released just a few days ago for the entirety of the NBA. You saw the Pelicans schedule, you saw the Grizzlies schedule, and the Trailblazers schedule. How do you think this, for the Pel specifically, how do you think it bodes for them, both theirs and the other teams, vying for these 8-9 spots?
Well, looking at some of the schedules, if you're a team like this is a Pelicans podcast, so we're going to be more concerned about the New Orleans outlook of things. The original schedules that were put out in which New Orleans had to play Memphis twice and be in a situation that unless they somehow are able to make up complete ground and maybe surpass Memphis, which I think is going to be a tough task with this amount of time and the amount of wins that they would have to put together. I think that New Orleans is in better shape. Now they only have to play Memphis once. Because if you get into a play-in tournament with the way that the old schedule was set up, you have to be in a spot in which you may have to beat Memphis four times just to get into a playoff situation to play LeBron and Anthony Davis. That's a lot to put on a team, considering what they were leaving before the season got suspended. I mean, I still think they have an uphill battle, but I think it matters that, the teams you look at a team like San Antonio that's below. LaMarcus Aldridge isn't going to be, in uniform. He isn't going to be playing. He's out recovering from surgery. Portland, of course, is right there, and they're currently tied with New Orleans, and I believe that considering the way that they put this thing together, the Pelicans actually, because of winning percentages, they're going to have to be a half game up on Portland to when this thing ends to be in the play-in tournament or to, you know, have the 8 seed depending on how Memphis does. But I mean that's just one of the aspects. Memphis, of course, before this, when the middle of March, they were missing Jaren Jackson Jr., they were missing Brandon Clark. Now both of these guys are gonna be back. We're looking at Portland, they're gonna be welcoming Nurkic back. I believe they're gonna welcome Zach Collins back. Now they'll lose Trevor Ariza. But a lot of these teams are gonna be healthier than they were. And it's going to be really important for New Orleans to get off to a fast start. Some of the matchups and what they have, I believe that they have a game against Orlando. That's going to be, you know, a good look for them. Some people are, you know, I've seen online, you know, we have some, you know, people that think that they can go, you know, 6-2 during this stretch or 7-1. I just want them to keep pace. And I think with the way that the schedule was set up, and I mean, you know, if you believe in the momentum that, you know, the NBA has with wanting Zion and LeBron facing off, you know, in that first round. I think we have a lot to look forward to. But when it's all said and done, while the Pelicans don't have the same chances, I think the chances are a little bit less than they were when the season suspended. I feel a little bit better looking at this schedule than the original one I did when, you know, the whole setup of this bubble was announced.
I'm honestly shocked that they don't have the Pels playing the Grizzlies twice. I don't know who made that final decision, but I mean, I'm more of in favor of it because now the Pelicans only have to beat them three times in order to move on to officially have that eight spot. But looking between these three teams in the Pelicans and the Trailblazers and the Grizzlies, it's obvious that the Pels have the easiest schedule. I mean, they have the easiest schedule remaining out of everybody that's left in the league. But the difference between the Pels and the Grizzlies' schedule for me is that looking at the Pelicans' schedule, it's incredibly front-loaded. You got the Jazz, you got the Clippers, and then it's six straight teams that don't have a lock on their playoff spot, unless you count Orlando. But, I mean, effectively, I think the Spurs are out of it. I think the Kings are out of it. I think the Wizards are out of it. And then you've got Orlando, Grizzlies, Jazz, Clippers in the Pelicans' schedule. And now, looking at the Grizzlies' schedule, for me, they got one guaranteed win. Looking at this, they got the Spurs. And to start off, they got the Trailblazers, who are completely healthy. Then it's Pels, Jazz, OKC, Toronto, Boston, and Milwaukee. So I feel like they're going to be limping to the finish line should they get that eight spot and face off against the Pelicans, who would be nine.
And I agree. I mean, my concern in this whole situation has been the bordering teams around the world more than Memphis. Because, you know, I think that, you know, with us, it's hard to project exactly what type of basketball we're going to be watching when, I mean, we're walking towards unknown territory. We don't know how playing in this style of, you know, which is, I mean, to me, AAU-style basketball, summer league atmosphere, you know, I mean, and even less than that, considering they won't be loaded fans, we don't know exactly how things are going to play out, who it's going to benefit. It's not going to be a real home court advantage, you know. So will guys be a little bit more loose than expected? You know, how much will veteran leadership play a role, as it did in regular style, you know, world situations? You know, I mean, you know, but, you know, pre-COVID. I'm not sure. So, you know, to me, my biggest thought process was, you know, you only have a handful of games here. The Pelicans are, you know, 3.5 back of Memphis. I didn't really believe that it was going to be that big of a change in regards to catching Memphis. But you can for sure keep them close. You can have them on their heels. for when the time comes for the play-in tournament for the Pelicans to be able to handle their business. And I know, you know, we talked about it before. I think out of the teams that Memphis would have to play, New Orleans is their worst matchup. I mean, it simply is. They stop Memphis from doing the things that they want to do. They have players in the right areas, and they play the right pace that, you know, doesn't allow Memphis to play a slower pace in regards to scoring. I know they're number one in the NBA, or they're the one or two in points of the paint or points in the paint when the year ended. New Orleans's pace gets them into a 3-point shooting contest in which they were, I believe, around 21st in the league in 3-point shooting, and we saw in both matches that they played. That was something that really put Memphis in a bad spot, trying to keep up with the pace New Orleans was playing. I definitely agree with you with that schedule. You know, that Memphis has. I mean, you could be looking at a situation where simply New Orleans plays a tired team, in combination with the fact that they match up well with them already. So, I agree with you there.
Now, for me, you said it, the teams that are below or at the same level as the Pelicans in terms of games back of that 8 spot, it's going to be those teams more like the Trailblazers, the Spurs, the Kings that are going to compete with the Pels for that 9 spot to match up with Memphis at 8. So my biggest fear in terms of those teams is definitely the Portland Trailblazers. They're getting, like you said, Zach Collins, Yusuf Nurkic back. Yeah, they lose Trevor Ariza, who's a big defensive piece. They don't have a defender who's a wing. Are they your biggest fear here? I mean, I'm looking at their schedule as well, and that 3.5 game disadvantage that these two teams have, and the Trailblazers have a pretty tough schedule too. I don't know if you have it in front of you or off the top of your head, but they play Memphis, Boston, Houston, Denver, the Clippers, Philadelphia, Dallas, and then Brooklyn. So is this your team that you fear the most that's competing for that 8-9 spot?
Well, you know, believe it or not, it was San Antonio before LaMarcus Aldridge went down. You know, I figured that in a situation like this, you're going to need a coach that has enough experience with people, with players, and has been in different types of adversity. Because you're going to have to find different ways to create energy, right? You're not going to be able to consume that energy from a fan base or being in your home stadium. You know, you're going to have to find different ways to establish momentum. And, you know, I mean, while guys play pickup basketball all the time, you know, I mean, it's, Playing professional pickup basketball, it's going to be a different type of scenario. And we got to also remember, in the midst of all of this, there's still a lot of things on the line for players involved. There are guys that they want to put on a showing, in a sense, to where future contracts can be handed out. I thought with everything considered, Greg Popovich and company, the San Antonio Spurs were going to be the biggest threat for New Orleans. But with Aldridge being out, I look at Portland, and you can never count out Dame Lillard. Now, while, you know, that team's been a little weird this year because trying to fit in Carmelo at one point, and even before Carmelo, while they had some injuries, they weren't playing all that great when they were together. And I don't know how big of a fix Nurkic is going to be. I mean, we'll have to see. We know Zach Collins was out in the beginning of the year. You know, they've been playing mixed and match with their roster and trying to make up for, you know, losses throughout the year. But even in previous years when they were hurt, when they had injury problems, Dame and CJ always found a way to make things work. And even if it meant beating a few teams that they weren't supposed to beat, we haven't really seen that this much. Well, we hadn't seen that a whole bunch this year from them. But, you know, of course, Dame was out, you know, a few times this year. CJ had a stretch where he missed a few games. You know, they had some run-ins, but we know throughout this bunch, I mean, we're talking the recent playoff experience. They were just in the Western Conference Finals a year ago. So a healthy Portland team with the leadership that they have in that locker room and the experience, And the fact that they don't, you know, they're right there with New Orleans, you know, I mean, that would be the team I would be keeping my eye on.
Right, right. They've got experience. The concern for them and the concern for other teams, I mean, it's kind of a toss-up how we're going to see Zach Collins and Yusuf Nurkic play. Because last year, Nurkic might have been one of the most underrated players in the league. But how is he going to contribute now after that injury coming back? And how is Zach Collins going to play? Are they going to be fit? Are they going to be able to keep up with the rest of these guys, even though the rest of them have come off quarantine as well?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's definitely a good point there. I mean, it's going to be interesting to see out of any of these teams who gets hot right away. You know, who's able to establish that special level of chemistry right away. You know, I mean, I keep saying it. You know, we don't know what's going to benefit teams in this type of setup. Is it going to be youth? Is it going to be veterans? You know what I mean? Is it going to be, you know, a mixture of both? What exactly is going to be the determinant factor? Every AAU tournament I've been to, Elliot, teams with the most talent win. That's just it. I've seen some ugly teams play. I've seen guys that they play all ISO basketball. But if they have the most talent, 9 times out of 10, they win. That's just the type of environment that that when you walk into those arenas, those areas, that's normally what happens. Which is why teams around the country are normally stacking however many elite prospects or future college players, NBA players that they can on one team. And they're able to go across the country because 9 times out of 10, these guys are immensely talented. And some of these guys never play with each other until they arrive on an AAU basketball team. So, you know, I'm trying to make sense of it the best that I can. But, you know, I mean, I would assume that it would help Portland if they would have had a chance to, you know, see how Nurkic and Zach Collins worked well with Carmelo, right, after previous years when this team was really good making playoff runs. They were working with more wings that didn't necessarily need the basketball to be effective than Al-Farouq Aminu and Mo Harkless and company. I mean, those were the type of guys that they were working with. Well, I mean, how's it going to work? How's Nurkic going to be able to work with Carmelo coming off of a leg injury in which I assume these games are going to be very much up and down. What type of condition is he going to be in, basketball shape-wise and regular shape-wise? Can those two play together? How is that going to work for your defense? I mean, you made a good point, man. We don't know what those guys are going to look like when they get back on the floor as well. But, I mean, again, with everything that's in the air right now, I'm only going off of what these guys look like on paper. And, you know, if there's two guys that I trust to find a way to make it work for this little short period, you know, for this eight-game stretch, this little regular season ending, if you will, I mean, you know, CJ and Dame have the resume for it.
There's just so many question marks as we go forward, and we've obviously never seen anything like this before. With what we've got in front of us, these eight games followed by what will more or less be a regular playoff series with the seven-game series and going all the way to the NBA Finals, is there any team that you see to be a dark horse that we may have considered out of the race before, but now that we've got this format, now that we've had this three-month hiatus, is there any team that you say, okay, this might change things for them?
In regards to winning a championship?
Yeah, be more underrated otherwise, and that you think get an advantage going into these NBA playoffs to win an NBA championship.
Man. You know, I mean, I'd be biased to say the Pelicans, right? But
you can say it, that's cool.
A team that a lot of people aren't talking about, overall, I mean, in the Eastern Conference, it's been mainly Milwaukee and Boston and company. I wouldn't count out the Toronto Raptors. I mean, I think right now they have the best overall coach in basketball, and Nick Nurse. You know, I mean, They were another team that had some injuries throughout the year, from Fred VanVleet to Kyle Lowry. But Pascal Siakam was having an all-NBA year before things got suspended. They're going to be welcoming Marc Gasol back. And if you've seen him, if you've seen videos of him lately, he looks to be in fantastic shape. Serge Ibaka, OG Anunoby. They have a team that is fit for any style that you want to play. If you want to play up and down, you want to play a fast pitch game, they can go small. If you want to play more of a half court style, they have the size for that. They have guys off their bench like Terrence Jones, a lot of people don't know about, but really good basketball player, really good rookie for them. Gave them some serviceable minutes. I look at Toronto, and I mean, sure, they have guys on that team that were a part of that championship run. No, there's no Kawhi Leonard, but if you have the best coach in basketball, and I think the coaching is going to matter now, maybe more than ever, because these guys are going to have to find ways to stay focused game in and game out and keep intensity, chemistry, and thing. I mean, there's not going to be many places to reach from, like there is in regular circumstances. So if there's a team that maybe will benefit from this, I mean, I mean, similar to what I was saying about the San Antonio Spurs, I'd look at a team that, arguably, in my opinion, has the best coach in basketball and a really good mixture of ascending talents, veteran leadership, and some young guys as well to provide energy when it's needed, because energy may be the thing that leads a team all the way in this type of circumstance.
Pair energy with veteran leadership, and that's what the Raptors have, and that's scary in a situation like this. I mean, you throw OG Anunoby in there, he's a guy with a really high ceiling, but he's just an energy guy for the Raptors right now, and that's a huge factor for them. And throw in that veteran leadership and Nick Nurse, who's arguably, like you said, the greatest coach in the league, and that team could be scary. So I'm going to throw one team from the Western Conference at you and another team from the Eastern Conference and see what you think. So this one, I say it a little tentatively. I say them both a little bit tentatively, I'm not going to lie, for different reasons. But from the Western Conference, I say the Houston Rockets. Now, their only center on their roster is 37-year-old Tyson Chandler, who has played, I think, a total of 16 games this season and averaged like 8 minutes a game, something like that. But by the time we get to June, by the time we get to May, Russell Westbrook and James Harden are both exhausted by that time in the league, just because their usage rate is so high. They dribble the air out of the basketball and they put up, 30 shots a game. But now the remainder of the season is so shortened where that could be really conducive to success. And these guys fill it up. We know that. They get to the free throw line. I'll give you a rebuttal on that, and then I'll give you my Eastern Conference team. What's your thought on that?
I'm not against Houston. We talk about AAU. I mean, it's a lot of isolation basketball in those type of scenarios and situations that fits right into what James Harden and Russell Westbrook want to do, pick up style basketball. I mean, I don't want to throw out the fact that, it's going to be a level of strategy and schemes that are involved. But when it's all said and done, these guys in some of these games, they're just going to be hooping, man. I mean, it's serious. When I go to summer league and I watch some of these guys play, they're hooping, man. And granted, it's different because these guys haven't, the majority of them haven't played any time with each other. But I mean, that's just, there's, the advantages are, are different, from what it is when you're playing in college or under normal circumstances with fans and advantages that lead off of the basketball floor, pressure and all those things. If you don't have Russell Westbrook and James Harden in their head, I mean, they could be in a situation. They have nothing to lose. Nobody's going to condemn the Rockets or James Harden or Russell in the same method that they would have before suspension as they would now. Simply not. It's not going to be a situation where you're looking or blaming James or blaming Russ or putting pressure on them to win a championship in this situation, because no one knows what the hell is going to happen. In fact, I think people are more concerned about, you know, the surprises and the underdogs that can sneak out than it's being talked about. And when you look at the fact that they're playing a unique style, and before the season suspended, Russell Westbrook was playing some of his best basketball than we've seen him play since a few years ago in Oklahoma City. You know, you add Robert Covington and P.J. Tucker. We see James Harden, and, you know, he appeared, I think, in a couple pictures a couple weeks ago to be in really, really good shape, cardiovascular shape. Yeah, I mean, Houston could be a team that takes some people by surprise and goes all the way to the finals, goes all the way into a championship series.
All right, my Eastern Conference team, it's going to be the Miami Heat.
I don't even want to hear you explain the Miami Heat. I don't want to hear it.
Okay, here's the thing. I wanted to say the Raptors, but then I gave it to you, you know. And it's so easy to say the Celtics too. I mean, anybody can go off on any night, but just hear me out. Hear me out. You can totally disregard it. Don't even have to respond to it once I'm done. But okay. So the culture in Miami that Pat Riley brought, and now that Jimmy Butler has probably intensified, is discipline. This team, season in, season out, with D-Wade, without D-Wade, they're getting after it. There's a culture in Miami that permeates to the rest of the team. I mean, they develop players like none other. Kendrick Nunn, who thought Duncan Robinson was going to be a viable option in the NBA? And you got, I mean, Jimmy Butler is not afraid of anybody. Bam Adebayo, arguably in consideration for most improved player of the year. So, you know, Pat Riley, you know, Eric Spoelstra, you know, Jimmy Butler's going to be on everybody's butt to have stayed fit, to keep getting working throughout this entire break. So that is my argument for the Miami Heat.
I understand that, while still thinking they're going to average 85 points a game in the playoffs. That's just how I look at them. I don't look at a team that, while they're going to be tough, and shout out to Larry Brown, but they're going to play basketball the right way, and they have a bunch of guys that are unheralded, and that's fine. You can speak about Duncan Robinson and, you know, and Kendrick Nunn and all these guys no one cares about. I mean, it's great, and Bam's fantastic. I love Bam Adebayo. I love him. I love him 100%. I love what he can do, you know, from a, you know, I mean, he's a kind of a point center. You know, he can handle the basketball. He can protect the rim. He can finish. He's not an exceptional shooter just yet, but can stress the floor a little bit for you. And they have the perfect leader. If I'm going into battle, I want Jimmy Butler with me. 100%. I'm with you there. Goran Dragic and company. I mean, you know, you got Tyler Hero. They have a bunch of dogs on that team. I'm with you. But they also, to me, do not have enough offense to overcome having to play Milwaukee or Toronto or Boston and having to deal with that length and athleticism in a 7-game series, in a long series. I don't think they can score enough points. So they can play all the defense that they want. They can be as tight-knit and tough and have a Pat Riley mindset as they want. But listen, there are a lot of Pat Riley teams, you know, when his hair was starting to turn gray, they were bounced out in the first round as well, okay? So, and I don't think this team's going to be any different. They're going to average 85 points a game. They'll win a few games against a good basketball team. But they're not. I mean, they're not good enough to get on a run and beat Milwaukee or Boston. You crazy?
Okay, touche. And I said it tentative. Okay, go ahead.
I'd like to see them play Indiana. I say that. I would like to see them play Indiana. I'd like to see TJ Warren and Jimmy again. You got me there.
They play each other twice, I think, before the end of the regular season. But I said it tentatively for two reasons for them. And I said it tentatively for the Rockets because of that small ball plan that they have going forward. But for the Heat, it was the offense, like you mentioned, and then they're also 14-19 away from home, so that's a bit of a concern. They don't have that home court advantage like they otherwise would.
No, 100%. I mean, they play, you know, really, really good basketball at home, and maybe that might be something that they were, of course, looking forward to when, I mean, we got to remember, I mean, Miami was, they were a top team in the West when the season, I mean, I'm sorry, in the East when the season first started. You know, I mean, they had people actually, you know, outside of you right now, they had people thinking that they could possibly make a finals run. I know that I see a few writers that, you know, that have them as their sleeper. You know, but I mean, I'm just not seeing it. I think at some point they're going to have to score 100 points, and I don't see them being able to do it consistently. And not saying they're a bad offensive team, but I don't think they have enough guys that can score consistently. I don't think you're going to be able to do it, Jimmy Butler being your number one guy, against the matchups that they're going to have to ultimately face, because, you know, the East to me isn't the West. I think I don't think that there's going to be much shake up there. I'm not going, unless, of course, COVID, I mean, hang in there, but, if things somehow stay safe and healthy, I think that Milwaukee, Boston, Toronto thing is what you're going to be looking at.
So we've seen Avery Bradley, Davis Bertans, Trevor Ariza, like we mentioned earlier, and Willie Cauley-Stein have all chosen to not participate in the remainder of the season, not because of injury or anything like that, but a lot of things, well, Bertans for injury because he's had those two ACL tears in his past, but Avery Bradley for his son, Ariza also for his son, and Willie Cauley-Stein, who will soon be a father. But do you expect this to snowball? Are there any other players? I mean, are there other players gonna follow this trend? Are they gonna continue to sit out? Do we see the snowball start to get rolling for social justice? What are your thoughts there?
I'd have to see the presentations that are done, Elliot. But in all honesty, man, I mean, I think the NBA is gonna say whatever they can and do whatever they have to make their players, quote unquote, happy. But I don't know how much. I mean, it's tough, man, because you need a lot more than special names on the back of a jersey, or, you know, patches or logos, or, you know, or even NBA players, you know, whether they're kneeling when they answer. I mean, whatever the case is, whatever special programming, planned protests or methods they choose to take, you know, it's not going to fix the overall structure of things, the systemic issues that plague minorities in this country. I mean, it's bigger than the NBA, you know. So, I mean, I look at people like, you know, Maya Moore, who decided to completely give up basketball for the near future. She's going to go into criminal justice because she understands that, you know, these problems, they exist in the law. They exist in the people that are pulling strings above all of us, and the powers. And sure, you'll be able to put something on TV that is going to be uncomfortable, maybe for some people, to make them have to talk. And maybe there's some kid out here that likes basketball and doesn't know who Breonna Taylor is. Okay. You know, they don't know who George Floyd is, and then it makes them look things up. But I mean, listen, you know, there's, in my opinion, there's nothing that the NBA can do that's going to make that large of an impact if we're talking the grand scheme of things. But I think it's a nice gesture, and I hope that it's something that they just don't do for this period. I hope they continue to do it. I hope that, you know, they go beyond this in regards to where they hold their, you know, their attention from a charity perspective, where they choose to donate money, what's worked into the next collective bargaining agreement in regards to how these players are marketed, and the overall control that they have towards overall social justice. I mean, the NBA players are some of the most recognizable athletes that you will find. So their faces and their their ability to influence. It does matter on a level, but like Avery Bradley mentioned, like Dwight Howard mentioned, Kyrie Irving to some level, it's a lot bigger than that. And I hope that people aren't getting. I hope that when a jersey, when an amazing jersey is put out, or any type of gesture that they put out on that floor, I hope that that doesn't take away their awareness from the things that we really need to change to help this country get better when it comes to race relations and police brutality and, you know, the overall, you know, the way that people that look like me are dying left and right without reason.
So we heard some stuff about the league, this being a distraction, getting back to basketball for social justice. You went into the depths of your feeling on just the entirety of getting back to basketball and everything. But do you believe that it is a distraction, or do you think that this is really going to be successful in terms of raising awareness? Because, I mean, it's hard to look in any direction right now in America and not hear something about race relations. So does getting back to basketball really help the situation?
I mean, I don't think it does. You know, I don't think it does. Now, is it necessarily a distraction? I mean, I wouldn't necessarily say that. I mean, I think that once again, if you're putting those elements out for people to see visually, it's something for people to think about. But when it's all said and done, you're gonna have fans and people that are watching, admiring of the game. They're gonna be thinking about the result of the game more so than the result of what happens to the next unarmed minority stopped by the police, or the way that, you know, police structures are set up, or you know, powers and laws that are in place that need to change. So, is it a distraction in a sense? You know, but I also do understand that, you know, that people need to get back to work in that area. I mean, how much of a job is it for these players to be to fix the things that are wrong in this country when they're just basketball players? You know, I get that standpoint as well. We have to hear a plan, you know, in place. I guess, you know, my only issue was I want this to be taken for what it is, period. It's a money grab. It's to financially keep the NBA on the trajectory that it's been going on once this pandemic is over with. You know, that's what this is truthfully about. I don't think it's about anything else. If we weren't talking about billions of dollars that were up to play here, I don't think the NBA would be resuming. But that's what it's about when it's all said and done. And I don't, you know, cool, you know, you're gonna make some nice T-shirts, make some nice patches, but this isn't gonna be about social justice, man. This isn't about anything else. This is about, by any means necessary, the NBA saving their checkbook, saving their dollars, and being able to keep things afloat going forward, which I understand that. But I just hope that, you know, I mean, I think that it doesn't have to be called a distraction if we don't try to make it seem like there are other things that are truthfully more important than that. And it isn't. It isn't. You know, it's not social justice. It's not the safety of these athletes. It's for these guys to keep this league afloat and make as much money as they can in that damn TV deal. I think if you come out and you're honest with it about that, if there was a way to let people know that and say, we also understand such and such is going on in this world, things need to change, this is what we're doing to help, people might respect me more. But I don't want, you know, what I don't like is kind of, you know, the false messages that are being sent, playing both sides, when I think we all know what the truth is. Kyrie and Dwight had trouble and 100% getting out what I guess was in their hearts. And who knows what it was, good or bad. It had a point in some areas. But when it's all said and done, you weren't going to be able to solve something that's been, you know, an issue in this country for over 400 years and, you know, over a summer. I don't know what their long term plans were in regards to this, but they have an opportunity to get through this summer and hopefully change the way this league is looked at beyond this time. And I don't know if they're able to do both. I don't know if they're able to make that much of a change. I just hope that I hope things continue to get better, and I hope that, you know, the NBA is genuine with what they say they want to change and they want to help.
Chris, that is one of the many reasons that we have you on this podcast, is that you keep it very real, and we greatly, greatly appreciate that. And it's not even Sunday by the time that our fans are listening to this, but you are out here preaching, my brother.
I love it.
So you put together an article on re-signing Josh Hart. I think it was about a month ago, 6 weeks ago. So how big of a role do you think he plays in this remainder of the season and or the playoffs?
Oh, I mean, he's huge, man. He's absolutely huge because, you know, we continue to go down this line explaining what this thing is going to be about, but, you know, who's going to hustle? Who's going to go and get the 50-50 balls? Who can come to a gym, no matter where it's at, no matter what type of situation is going on, no matter who they're playing with or their opponent, and give you the same amount of energy? Josh Hart. It didn't matter if this team was playing the New York Knicks or they were playing the Los Angeles Lakers. You got the same guy. You know, he was consistent with his output. Now, his shooting, you know, could fluctuate, but defensively, rebounding, hustle, his passion, his energy always stayed. And in a situation, going forward, and, you know, a COVID active NBA season under this type of climate, you need guys like Josh Hart. You needed him before. But, you know, you're going to need him even more because, I mean, again, we don't know what type of players are going to be counted on and what type of players aren't. So I've written about Josh Hart multiple times since he's joined New Orleans. I'm a huge fan. And when it's all said and done, his attention to detail, his passion, his energy, his overall fight, his grit, it's, you know, you can't replicate that. And I wouldn't be surprised if Alvin looks at him, you know, throughout this time and say, you know what, you know, you're going to be one of our most important players here, man. I mean, you know, you're going to, you know, I'm going to throw you out there in almost any situation, and I expect you to get things done. And John Guy is going to be up to the challenge for that.
The thing about Josh is that he's just not quite big enough to guard those guys like LeBron, like Giannis, and that's such a big need that the Pelicans have. And they tried to get it from Kenny Hustle, who didn't really live up to the name this season. I mean, early on he had it, but the Pelicans just need that. And Josh Hart, he is great defensively, and he's great off the bench, but he's just not quite that yet. And Drew's not big enough to be that guy. And Ingram is progressing defensively, but he's still skinny and still primarily a scorer. But that's just a huge need that the Pelicans have this offseason.
Hey, Pels fans. Going to take a quick break here. I want to remind you, if you're listening on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher, make sure you leave a 5-star rate and review. That really helps us out here on the podcast. Only takes a couple seconds if you want to do that. Once again, if you are a fan, if you are an avid listener of Believe in the New Orleans Pelicans, make sure to do that. Make sure to hit the follow button. That really, really, really helps us out. Now, let's get back to the podcast.
I'm going to hit you with one more Josh Hart question, and then we're going to get back to that. But do you think the Pels should extend him this offseason or put Lonzo Ball as their priority and see if they can get him to come back even next season if Lonzo isn't open to signing an extension this offseason?
I think you have to go the Lonzo route. As much as I do, as I would like Josh Hart to be a part of the team going forward, Lonzo Ball pulls more strength. And his connection with Zion Williamson is one of the most important connections. It could arguably be the most important connection of their future going forward. You got to find a way to retain that guy while also not breaking the bank with unknown cap structures upcoming post-COVID. I think if you wait a year, I don't know how much Josh Hart's value is going to overall change. But you have to let him know how important he is, but there has to be a pecking order, along those same lines. And I think Josh has enough awareness to know that he may not be number one on the list, but it doesn't make him any less important. Lonzo would be the guy, if we're talking about those two. As much as I like Josh, I'd have to find a way to take care of Lonzo Ball first.
So back to that question that we mentioned, and I'm in the same boat. You got to go Lonzo first there. You just have to. As much as we both love Josh Hart, it's got to be Ball. I mean, he's perfect point guard for Gentry's system. Obviously, the chemistry with Zion is huge, and Ball is going to be a top five point guard in the league if he's not close to that already. So we've been running this question by everybody who's been on this podcast. David Grubb, Ollie Cosell. I don't think we got it with Preston because that was so long ago, but Will Guillory as well. The Pels, that's the big need, is a wing defender. If there's going to fill any void this offseason, it's got to be that, because, like I said, Kenny Hustle ain't doing it. Josh Hart is great off the bench, but he's not quite that guy yet. If you're looking for anybody this offseason to fill that role, personally, I like the idea of Mo Harkless, because that's going to probably be affordable. He's 27, and so you get to keep him around for 2-3 years and see if he can fill that role and preferably figure out quicker rather than later. But ideally, which I highly doubt the Pelicans will be able to afford him this offseason unless he's looking to win a championship and move out of Denver, but Jeremy Grant, I think, would be an ideal grab for that position as well. So whether it's realistic or not, I really like that. Is there any other name that you have thought of in this position, in filling this void that the Pelicans deeply, deeply need?
I mean, unfortunately, I think, we have to figure out exactly what happens with, say, like, a Derek Favors, for example. You said Jeremy Grant is the guy that you have your eyes on, right?
That would be the most ideal situation. And to throw out another name, there's a guy like a Jay Crowder, but I know he wants a bigger role. He wants to compete for a championship as well. And so I'm looking at those wing positions. But like you said, Derek Favors is obviously a huge, huge deal to deal with this offseason as well.
Yeah. I look at the team right now. Yes, they need another guy, between 6'5" and 6'8". Or 6'6" and 6'8", 6'9", somewhere in that range that can guard some of those presences. But I mean, we also have to accept that if we're measuring this up against success against LeBron James, we're probably kidding ourselves. because he's the best player in our game still. And he does that to a lot of teams in the NBA. So, I mean, he's done that over the course of his long, illustrious career. My feelings on that, I mean, would a guy like, say, a Marcus Morris type, fit? Would he be somebody that, they should look into for a stretch to help those type of built players? Sure. But I would be more so concerned of figuring out what your goal is going to be long term at the center position. And I think I would continue to help develop Zion Williamson defensively. I'm sure that if he's in the shape that everyone is speaking about, that's going to play a good influence on him and his ability to be an overall condition to not only play this pace and get up and down the floor, but save enough juice to be able to rotate defensively. And then from a mental standpoint, he still has some things that he has to grasp about, not just using his athleticism and his instincts, but knowing what a team is doing before it's coming. He's smart enough to make that happen. But Brandon Ingram is the guy I'm looking at, And I've seen videos and have been told that, he's been working on his strength. He's the guy that is perfectly built, if he's a little bit stronger, to to deal with some of these guys. But Kevin Durant, first guy in the league, Oklahoma City has to get a bunch of different wings to guard the LeBron James, to guard the bigger, you know, the bigger players, because not only with, you know, with KD as long and tall as he was, not only was he not strong enough, he wasn't the defender that he eventually became. And whether teams decided to put him on screens or, you know, just isolate him and maybe risk getting him in foul trouble, that's what happened. As he got stronger, he got smarter, he knew what he could and couldn't do, we saw KD become a better defender. And over the past 2 years, 3 years before his injury, he was pretty good in some stretches. I think with Brandon, it's a similar thing. As opposed to going out and getting another guy right away, if you can get the right one, perfectly fine. But as opposed to going out and focusing on whether it should be Jeremy Grant, who I don't see how in hell, you know, the Pelicans will be able to get. If I'm Denver, there's not a way in hell I'm letting a guy like him go. But if you can simply help Brandon Ingram develop his strength physically, and help him in regards to getting off of screens, because to me, that's his biggest thing, fighting off of screens and being able to recover. The energy is there, the smarts is there, the length is there, but he's gonna have to get stronger and find ways to fight off screens and recover on guys, because that's how people normally take advantage of him. And, you know, he's also very, very active and can be a little bit too aggressive and get himself in foul trouble. We saw that in the Dallas game where he ended up fouling out of the game, in which he brought them in close range of winning that game in Dallas, right, a few games before suspension due to COVID. But he's the guy that I want guarding those type of players. Maybe not for long stretches, because you want to preserve some of him offensively. But he has the perfect size for, the perfect height, the perfect length. We just got to get him stronger. If you can do that and you can figure out where you're going to go long term at center, I think they'll be all right there. I think that they'll be able to make things happen along with Zion Williamson becoming an overall better defender, et cetera.
And that's a solution that we haven't brought up here on the podcast. And we've talked about it a little bit, but not quite that in depth. So if we were to go right into the solution, let's say, of signing somebody and also figuring out a Derek Favors deal. First of all, Derek Favors has made plenty of money in his NBA career. He's in a situation now where he can start as opposed to be the second fiddle to Rudy Gobert, where like he was in Utah. So personally, I think the option that is best, if they're going to figure that out, is give Derek Favors a $10 million deal, maybe a 1+1, have all that money front loaded in case they want to sign him to an extension, give him some more money the following year, assuming he's still healthy and everything, and then go out and get, and I was thinking Marcus Morris too. I would prefer in a situation like this that they get somebody a little bit younger, like a Mo Harkless, despite the thin stature that Harkless has. But out of respect for your time, probably good to move forward, unless you had anything to say on that as well.
No, I mean, I like where you're going with that. I mean, I mean, the Pelicans have enough assets. They have enough talent on this team and flexibility to go, a bunch of different ways. So I'm with you there.
All right, so now we have a bit of a surprise topic here on Believe in the New Orleans Pelicans. If you follow Chris and I, Chris at Impatient Bull, by the way, and I'll give you that reminder at the end of the show, but awesome Pelicans content and New Orleans sports content from Chris there. But if you follow both of us or one of us on Twitter, you saw that we interacted with a CBS sports list of the top 10 running backs going into this season. So what it looked like to me and what Grubb brought up, because David Grubb and Ross Jackson, is it Ross Jackson from Locked On Saints? I think that's who it was.
Ross is my guy.
All right. So us four talked about a list that CBS Sports brought up, and Chris and I greatly, greatly disagree with it. So surprise football content here on Believe in the New Orleans Pelicans, and Chris and I are going to go back and forth, and if that's okay, if that sounds good to you, Chris, and give our top 10 NFL running backs going into this season. We're thinking not necessarily statistically from last season, but just overall talent. So I'll start off with my number 10, and we'll go to your number 10, Chris. How does that sound?
I like that. Ooh, this is going to be fun.
I don't think I've ever heard you make that sound before. I like that. Ooh.
Yeah, I didn't see it that way. I thought we were gonna go by it, you know, all at once. But I like the method. You it's almost like you know what you're doing. Like you've been doing the show for a little bit, right?
Yeah, and we have fun here, Chris. So my number 10 is Oakland Raiders running back and second year running back Josh Jacobs. I think that coming out of last year's NFL draft when he was picked, clear and away the best running back in last year's class. It was not close. I thought he was complete. I think he's going to be great for years to come, assuming no injuries, assuming that, you know, and it's tough right now with running backs too because you don't want to pay them because they're replaceable. But I think Josh Jacobs is going to be one of those guys who can do anything and everything you ask him to. I wouldn't be surprised by the end of the season if I have him in my top five. But going into this season, I got him as my top 10.
Okay. I like that, and I respect that. So the first thing I'll say is I'll let you know the guys that just missed. They just missed my list. I have Josh Jacobs, Melvin Gordon, and Joe Mixon just missing my top 10. Say that fast, Mixon and missing. So I had those three missing. Number 10 is a guy that a lot of people have forgotten about due to him being stuck in that rough state of organizational affairs right now in New York, Le'Veon Bell. So my thing with Le'Veon is that I didn't expect much from him last year, coming off of just missing a full year, getting himself back in shape, adjusting to a new system. And you throw in the Sam Darnold mono troubles and just everything that was going on there in, you know, with New York. And I think Darnold missed a couple of other games with a nagging injury. We saw a few too much of Josh McCown there. From a weapons perspective, they were missing Chris Herndon Jr., their tight end, who was when it's playing is a really good red zone threat and has been one of Sam Darnold's more preferred targets. They had some things that they needed to figure out there, and the offensive line wasn't very good. So I didn't expect Le'Veon Bell to do a whole bunch. Actually, coming from Pittsburgh, where he was always surrounded by great talent and commitment and an offensive play caller. But this year going forward, I think he's going to bounce back. I think he's going to be hungry again, ready to prove something. I think he's one of the more unique talents that we have at running back in the league. He's a guy in today's league that can do both, which is very important. He can catch out the backfield. He can line up a wide receiver. He's a decent blocker, and we know he can run the ball, even if it's, you know, his stop and go and his style of running is a little bit different. I expect Le'Veon to have a bounce back year with a much improved offensive line. Sam Darnold, even with everything that's going on with Jamal Adams and all the drama there, I think if there isn't enough of a season that goes on in that division without Brady, I think it just can surprise some people, and Le'Veon Bell will be the bell cow. How you like that?
Nice. Big fan. I have Bell and Joe Mixon just outside my top 10 too. It's hard with players like that. And like when LaDainian Tomlinson came off his MVP season where we just expected it to all be the same. And then we just have this high standard for these type of players. And then when they have a little bit of a down year, we're like, oh, forget about them. They're not that good. And I think Le'Veon Bell's last season was like that as well. That, like you said, Jets offensive line might be one of the worst in the league last year, at least. They were real bad. And so I think this year is pivotal for Le'Veon Bell for sure. I think if he's going to bounce back, it's got to be this year because otherwise nobody's going to want to pay him. So we'll see what we get from Bell this year. My number 9, who I think is probably one of the most underrated running backs in the league. I wanted to have him higher, but I just couldn't based on the production of these other backs that we're going to talk about in a second. Aaron Jones out of Green Bay. I love me some Aaron Jones. I had him as a guy who I thought was going to get better and better and be one of the best backs in the league before he really made his ascension. Before they got Matt LaFleur, it was obviously a pass-happy team with Aaron Rodgers at quarterback, future Hall of Famer. But I love Aaron Jones. I think he's going to continue to be really successful. He's excellent out of the backfield catching the ball as well. So Aaron Jones, number 9.
Man, are we like Twins, but did you like see my list beforehand?
Promise I didn't cheat.
I have Aaron Jones as my number 9 pick. So he's not a guy that, you know, in my eyes, I don't find him being a dude that's extremely explosive. But I think he's a guy who's dependable. Another guy who can catch the ball out of the backfield, who was a touchdown machine last year. I mean, and let's be honest, I mean, if you're on the boat that I am, you know, that I'm on in regards to Aaron Rodgers and thinking that, you know, I don't necessarily know how much of a step that he's lost, but I mean, it's a stride something. I don't believe he's the same quarterback that he was 3 or 4 years ago, which I think is okay. I think it's okay as long as they continue to not draft a quarterback and trade up for him in the first round. Wait a minute, they did that, but never mind. Okay. I mean, Aaron Jones was one of the more dependable guys on that offense last year when guys went out, when Devontae Adams was hurt, when Scotty Valdez was hurt, the left of the course that was left of Jimmy Graham was hobbling out there. I mean, Aaron Jones was dependable. He showed up. He was another guy I know. I mean, he did miss a game or two. They had to lean on Jamal Williams and a couple of other guys. But, you know, I mean, Aaron Jones was there, and he's a big part of the offense. Matt LaFleur has made it known that he wants to run the football. It's what he did coming from Tennessee. I think he fits. They have a really good offensive line. As long as he can stay upright, I mean, when you look at both of the things he can do in a screen game too, perfect number 9. I like to see him break off more longer runs consistently for me to completely be a fan, but he makes the list.
Also, I think Jamal Williams is the perfect tandem. Those two are the perfect tandem together because Jamal Williams is the exact opposite. He's a punch you in the mouth kind of running back. So I love that pair. And then they just got another one in A.J. Dillon. I just thought their draft this last year was atrocious, but we don't have to talk about that right now. But my number eight is Chris Carson. We talked a little bit about this on Twitter of Chris Carson was number 5, I believe, on that list, and Alvin Kamara wasn't in that top 10. And I was a little shocked by that. With Chris Carson's good. I mean, you have to be talented to get the ball out of Russell Wilson's hand in that offense. 1,200 yards this last year, 7 touchdowns, and he's made it clear that he's the number one running back. And even though they took Rashad Penny in the first round just a few years ago, Penny's going to be a third down back for them for a while. And Chris Carson having those type of stats is a little bit easier when you have Russell Wilson at your quarterback just because he's such a threat. But Seattle has yet to figure out their offensive line as well. You have to factor that in. With those type of stats, that's pretty impressive.
I probably here should have mentioned Chris Carson as the guy that I also left off my list.
Okay.
Chris Carson did not make it. It's not that I'm not a fan of Chris Carson. It's his fumbling does bother me. It's been something that's been a problem constantly throughout his career. I do think that he is a good running back, but I was excited to see Rashad Penny when Chris Carson got hurt. I thought Rashad was going to have similar numbers, if not better. It just didn't end up working out that way. They for surely missed him in the playoffs and in that last, and I believe that they would have beat the 49ers in that Week 17 game if they would have had either of them, in all honesty. But it didn't work out that way. Number 8 on my list is actually Leonard Fournette.
Okay.
I look at Leonard. He had a very quiet year if you didn't watch Jacksonville Jaguars football last year, and I don't see why you would have. It really wasn't much to watch after Jalen Ramsey left. But one thing I liked about Leonard is that I always knew that he could run the ball between the tackles. That wasn't a worry of mine with him. I figured that would be something that he would – when he was being compared to being the next Adrian Peterson coming out of LSU, it was because he could run the football and he gave you a punishing style. But his problem was that he wasn't able to catch the ball out of the backfield. He wasn't much of a threat, which is why you saw guys like T.J. Yeldon and guys of that mode. But last year, you know, he really stepped up big time in regards to his ability to be more flexible, screen plays, catching it as a receiver. I mean, he had a career high in receptions, I believe. And, I mean, he was top five in the entire NFL from a running back position. He didn't get any touchdowns, but he gave you 76 receptions and 522 yards. If that's going to be who he is long term on that off with that offensive line, which is also pretty decent in Jacksonville, they got to figure out their quarterback position long term. I think I'm not a big Minshew guy, but I definitely think that, you know, if he can, you know, in a year in which he has to show something, because some people may not have thought he was going to be a fit long term, and people are trying to move away from those bell cows that can't do anything for you on third down. He cracked my top 10 just because of his overall improvement as a receiver.
I have him outside of my top 10 as well, probably because I didn't see much of him last year. Like you said, it's tough to watch the Jaguars, the state of their franchise at the moment. But he is talented. He's somebody that I really looked forward to watching coming out of the league. And then do you remember what he said in preseason of his rookie year?
Not off the top of my head.
He said that the NFL was easy, and then he lost me.
I do remember that now that you mentioned it, yeah.
All right, my number 7, Minnesota Viking, Dalvin Cook. So I have Cook at 7. I think he is uber talented. I love watching Dalvin Cook play. I thought the Vikings got a steal when they got him. I think it was in the second or third round just a few years ago, but I am a huge Dalvin Cook guy. But the thing that this is contingent upon is when he is healthy. This guy is stupid, stupid good, but when he's on the football field. That's the thing that I'm dealing with here at number 7 for Dalvin Cook. I think he's got all the tools that you need for a franchise running back. He can block, catch out of the backfield, shifty, just quicker than hell. And yeah, I'm a big Cook fan. I think he's really great for that Vikings offense. I think he adds a piece that's more dynamic now that they don't have Stephon Diggs. And, you know, Kirk Cousins is their quarterback, and how dynamic can that guy be?
So I like that, man. When you mentioned Aaron Jones, I had a hunch that you were looking off of my list somehow. But now that you picked Dalvin Cook in the same spot that I did, I know you. Dalvin Cook is also, I'm wrong. Actually, we are not twins. I apologize. Nick Chubb is seventh on my list.
Okay.
So this is my only thing with Nick Chubb. This can be subjective, but I have a preference. I worry that while he is an exceptional runner of the football, exceptional, his quarterback is going to turn the football over a lot. I just feel that is who Baker Mayfield is. And when this team, if they put in situations where they get behind in football games, Kareem Hunt will be on the football field a little bit more. He's a guy who is a little bit more explosive as a receiver out of the backfield. I don't question Nick Chubb as a runner. I believe he ran for close to 1,500 yards last year. But he didn't have the opportunities at a third down back and for a guy who has some history with injury that I would necessarily like to see, because everybody else that is above him is either A, just an all-world runner, or B, are the best dual threat talents that we have out of the backfield. So I couldn't put Nick Chubb in that category to say, even though he's a fantastic runner, really great breakaway speed. So I'm a fan, but I couldn't put him any higher than that. I'm interested to see what you have on that.
Yeah, we'll get to him in a little bit here. So my number 6, a little bit. Just give me a second here, Chris. number 6 here is Alvin Kamara for me. I wanted to put him higher. We talked about this, about him not being in that top 10 of that list. And, you know, we're a little bit biased here towards New Orleans, but that third year here for Kamara, it just, he kind of fell off. He didn't fall off a cliff, but he didn't have the production that we were expecting. A ton of people were taking him number one overall in their fantasy football drafts. He played in 14 games, ran for 797 yards, 5 touchdowns, and then he caught 3 years in a row, he caught 81 passes. That's kind of wild. And then 533 yards and just 1 touchdown receiving this year. And I mentioned how Dalvin Cook is dynamic, and that's basically what Alvin Kamara is. He's not a blocker. He does run the ball. He does run the ball, but he's more known for a guy who is really great in the open field and is a great weapon that Sean Payton has used very much so in the last few years. Just took a dip this year, and I think he will be back in that top five area for me should he have a bounce back year in 2020.
Okay. I'm not mad at that. We're not that far off of what we have Kamara. I just have him a little bit higher than you do.
Sure.
Next up on my list is actually Dalvin Cook, who you just, you know, got finished missing it about. Like, he wasn't worthy of being a little bit higher than Nick Chubb, who I assume is in your top five, top four, which is ridiculous. But so Dalvin Cook,
a little bit of conviction in that.
Right. So yeah, I mean, Dalvin Cook for me is, I have him at 6. The only thing that's keeping him, I think, from reaching that top five, in my opinion, is, like you said, durability. And his durability is such a question, it's such a worry, that, I mean, Minnesota, it's almost in their game plan that if they get up by a certain amount of points, then it could be 14-21 in the fourth quarter, he's coming out. You know, we're going to see Alexander Mattison or, you know, whoever is the backup there, you know, for that given day, or, you know, Mike Boone. I mean, whoever, we're going to see other guys carry the football. We know he's explosive. My only problem with Dalvin, as we know, he can catch out the backfield. And, I mean, with the improvements that they made to the offensive line and their overall commitment to the running game, it's great. But is Dalvin that bell cow guy? Is he that bell cow guy, and how much are they going to utilize him, you know, enough to where if you give him the ball in a limited capacity, he's still able to make huge impacts? I'm not sure about that because he's often been hurt. Or, you know, he hasn't been supposed to be when he was drafted. So, yeah, I mean, but I still think he's one of the better talents that we have in the league. I believe in him, but I need to see him hold up, you know, for 16 games and do it at a pace that allows him to continue the role that he was on earlier, mid last season, where, you know, it felt like he was going to lead the NFL in almost every rushing category before Derrick Henry just went ape shit. You know?
Speaking of Derrick Henry, number 5, Derrick Henry for me.
Wow.
50. Okay. Yeah. Hear me out. 1,540 yards, led the league in rushing last year. But this dude is a one-trick pony. That is all you're getting from Derrick Henry. He's going to pop you in the mouth. He is. And he's the reason that the Titans went on that playoff run and were looking like they were going to give the Chiefs some trouble in the AFC Championship. But I think their offense is one-dimensional because of Henry, and you can't blame him for that. He's a great running back, 102 yards per game this season in 2019. But there's a reason that they brought in Deion Lewis in 2019 as well. They needed a guy to be a third down back, catch the ball out of the backfield. I've never been a big Derrick Henry guy. Obviously, he's talented. He led the league in rushing, like I said, 16 touchdowns on the ground. But then you look at his receiving stats, and he caught a total of 18 passes last year for 206 yards. Okay, fair. A little bit better than what I thought it was going to be, 2 touchdowns. But like I said, one-trick pony. For me, if you're going to be higher on this list, you got to be able to do more.
Okay, and you know what? And I will answer all of your Derrick Henry concerns as we continue to go further up the list. you know, because, I mean, I I've made it a thing to value running backs that can do both. So Derrick Henry being a little bit high of the list may be a little bit of a contradiction, but I have a reason why, and I kind of explained it. But next on my list is Alvin Kamara. Listen, I think the only reason Alvin Kamara didn't go Marshall Faulk on the lead last year is because he got hurt, period. If Alvin doesn't get hurt earlier in that year, we probably see them being, you know, him being as explosive as he was in that Houston and that Seattle game. Something happened between there to where he started to, he wasn't the same explosive guy. He wasn't breaking the amount of tackles as we are accustomed to him doing. And he didn't have the same burst. But if Alvin is upright and you use him right, now I think he's similar to Dalvin Cook in a state to where I don't think you can build your whole offense around him. You shouldn't have to. It wasn't what he was drafted for. But we've seen them be able to use him in a high volume, but split it up in ways to where he's not receiving or taking a bunch of contact repeatedly. I think in that type of role still, maybe a little bit more than what he was doing when Mark Ingram was there, but I think in that type of role, you're still looking at an elite running back in football. I think that CBS list had him at number five, and number nine. They had him way down the list.
I don't even think he was on the list.
No. You know what? You're right. It was another list I saw in which he was number nine. That list we were talking about, he didn't even crack the top 10. You're right. I think you're right on that. So, I think Kamara is one of the more special and unique talents that we have in the league. If you use him correctly and he's healthy, I think they'll be able to do that. He can run inside the tackles. He can run outside. He can catch out the backfield. He can catch as a receiver. He can catch and go. He can break long runs. He can do it all. I think that's the type of guy in today's league who should be in your top five. I'm disappointed in you for not having him.
Touche. I mean, he's a perfect toy for Sean Payton to play with. And yeah, Taysom Hill is kind of known as a Swiss Army knife, but Kamara is an excellent weapon for Sean Payton's offense. My number four is Nick Chubb. I did not have him any higher than that. I thought that Chubb, and a little bit, I'm not going to lie, a little bit of having him in that number four position is potential because we haven't seen a ton of him. We've seen two seasons, I believe, of Nick Chubb, and I love what I've seen. I think he was a very large bright spot in what was a very bad year for the Cleveland Browns. I think, and you mentioned it, Baker Mayfield is, that was a really rough year last year. And I mean, he's throwing picks, and if you're throwing picks, you're not able to put the ball in your running back's hands. That's just it. I mean, he had almost 1,500 yards, 8 touchdowns last year, and receiving 36 receptions, 278 yards. I think Chubb is going to continue to be a top-level running back in this league, but won't ascend to anything to the level of the players I'm going to mention here. But the potential is there for him to continue to get better, to continue to be a bell cow. But you also mentioned Kareem Hunt. I think the more Hunt gets back into the groove of things of playing football, I think he's going to continue to take carries away from Chubb as well. So, I mean, I think it could go one way or the other, and I chose to put him a little bit higher.
So, that's interesting because we have a similar conflict here. You have Derrick Henry lower, just like I have Nick Chubb lower for similar reasons. It's just that I think that Derrick Henry is a superior back, like if we're talking for what they do and what they're supposed to do. But I mean, Nick Chubb was fantastic last year. I mean, he simply was on a team that had a lot of issues. As they continue to commit, especially if they're going 12 personnel, two tight ends, and they're running the football as their new coach has talked about, I mean, he might even be better. You know, and that should help Baker out, who should have more play action options. And with those weapons he has, I mean, Cleveland could do something special if you're allowed to say things like Cleveland and special together.
Fair enough.
Fourth on my list is Ezekiel Elliott. I am not a huge Zeke fan. I do not think he was the same guy last year. He did not. He's another guy that did not look himself. He does not has not looked as fresh and light and quick and fast. I mean, it's not many large 20, 40 gas yard runs, but he is one of the most complete running backs in football still. Even with that, he still had a decent year last year, a good year. It wasn't great, you know, we saw some of Tony Pollard. You know, he didn't do anything that made me, you know, that was eye-popping, but he was consistent. You know, he was top five in the NFL in rush yards per game. He still, you know, did what he was supposed to out of the backfield as a receiver when he was called upon, catching the ball 54 times. He had a quiet 1,300 yards that I didn't even realize he had last year. He rushed for over 10 touchdowns, you know. Zeke is, you can make an argument if you throw pass protection into the equation, you can make an argument he's the most complete football running back. But I like explosion. And, you know, I mean, if I'm looking at just player profiles or what I think they're going to do long-term, who I would want my top 10, my top three, he's not getting there. But I would be wrong, and it would be egregious to not have him in the top four at least. So I did, he did make it there.
With that said, I do have Zeke at three. So kind of similar thoughts. Like you said, I think he's the most complete running back in the league. I think he does everything well. I think coming out of Ohio State, he was one of the last running backs besides Saquon Barkley, where I think everybody collectively was like, that's a first round running back. And Zeke, the offensive line in Dallas kind of fell off last year. Zeke was coming off struggling with the getting a contract done with the Cowboys, had some off the field issues. So I'm going to give it to him this last year and give him the benefit of the doubt. But like you said, I mean, 301 carries, almost 1,400 yards, 12 touchdowns. Kind of fell off in terms of receptions. 2018, he had 77 for three touchdowns. This year, he had 54, 420 yards, two touchdowns. And last year, had 567 yards. So Zeke took a bit of a step back this year, but everything going on, I mean, I think the league is starting to figure out Dak Prescott. I did not think that he was worth a huge contract. So good move by the Cowboys in not giving him that big contract. But yes, I have Zeke at three just because of, like I said, the complete ability of Zeke despite his lack of, not necessarily lack of production, but a step back in production last year.
Fair enough, fair enough. Number three for me is Saquon Barkley. The ultimate, I mean, if I'm building a running back, I mean, he's the guy I would build on Madden when I would create running back. he's it. And I mean, he's everything Adrian Peterson was plus more. I mean, he just, when you look at his speed, you look at how he can catch the ball out of the backfield, his acceleration, his burst, his power, pass protection is, you know, is decent, even though I would hardly ever have him out there. Saquon can do it all, but you don't need him doing it all because he will get hurt. And most people will. If you have an entire offense on them, it's very hard to have, you know, full responsibility of an offense unless you're Derrick Henry, and still be productive and stay upright. It's just very, very, very hard. But I believe it's, I think this could be a year, second year of Daniel Jones, in which Saquon really breaks out. And as long as he's still running the way that he is, as long as he's as good of a football player as he is, I don't care if he has 2 yards for a season, he's going to be in my top three because you just, you can't find guys like him. They don't make him very often.
You hit it on the head. Basically every point I was going to make, I have Saquon at number two. This guy is, he is a created running back. In 2018 he was drafted? 2018 and probably back to 2015, 2014 in that area when the offenses really stopped drafting these running backs super high. Saquon was taken number two overall. That just doesn't happen now. And, I mean, you look at this guy's quads and, I mean, he's an NFL running back. That's like, you just look at this guy walking down the street and like, that dude plays for the Giants. I am never going to mess with that guy. But like you said, the offense was completely its success was based on Saquon, and that's why he got hurt this year. I think Daniel Jones takes a step forward this year. I think the offense, they start to trust him a little bit more. He starts airing the ball out a little bit more. That takes some of the pressure off Barkley. I think the offensive line got a little bit better this year as well. So, Barkley number two for me.
And number two for me is the man you hated on with no reason. No reason for it, man. Derrick Henry. How could you not have a guy, okay,
He's still top five. He's still top five.
I mean, how could you not have the guy that led the league in rushing? I don't care if he didn't catch the ball at all. He led the league in rushing. He led the league in rushing touchdowns over the was tied for with Aaron Jones. Sure. I don't get it. I don't get it. I mean, out of all the guys that had at least, what, 13 carries per game, he had the highest rushing yards per attempt. And he led this team on the back of his golden dreadlocks to the AFC Championship game. Come on, man. Like, he's a throwback. He's a throwback, and yes, he does not catch the ball out of the backfield very often. It's not one of his strengths. I understand that. But the thing he does well, he does better. Or he proved last year he does better than anybody else in football. I can't tell you the last time we've seen a running back since we've moved to this era of throwing the football and it being so quarterback important. When's the last time have we seen a running back pretty much by himself carry a team to an AFC championship game? I mean, it doesn't happen often. It hasn't happened without a major injury, it hasn't happened in recent history. He got Ryan Tannehill paid. Come on, man. He got Ryan Tannehill paid, man, by his damn self. Derrick Henry is the second best running back in football. And I'm probably disrespectful for putting him there, but the guy above him is the guy we both have number one, and we would both be fools not to have him there.
Yes, we would. Christian McCaffrey, easy choice. So worth getting paid. The dude, I mean, he made the Panthers offense go last year. He's going to do the same thing this year. Teddy Bridgewater at quarterback, I think, was a good sign. Cam Newton is better than a lot of starting quarterbacks in this league, but I'm over Cam Newton for the most part. I think his best years are behind him, that shoulder shot. And Christian McCaffrey made that offense go. I am a huge McCaffrey guy. I love his game. I thought coming into the league, honestly, he was just going to be a third down back, like Danny Woodhead type. Not like more productive than that, but McCaffrey is, I mean, he put on a ton of weight, has continued to work hard. Probably should have won the Heisman the year that Derrick Henry won the Heisman, but McCaffrey is my number one guy here at the running back position.
I mean, you said everything that I could possibly say. I mean, he's everything right now that I would have wanted Reggie Bush to be when he was drafted. You know, people were worried about McCaffrey's size and his ability to run between the tackles. And, you know, I was too. I didn't think he would be able to keep things up as long as he did at that rate. You know, just, I mean, we're talking about Kyle Allen was his quarterback, man. And, you know, for a while, you know, the Panthers were in contention, or they had a shot to snag one of those wild card spots. Sure, they have weapons on the outside, but Christian, that team is all about Christian. It goes through him, through his ability as a runner. I mean, you know, he was able to bust out runs against that San Francisco 49ers defense. And it's just, you know, I think, man, it's something. And it's similar to Derrick Henry, which is why I put Derrick at number two. When a team has to put their whole game plan around you consistently and they still can't stop you, you're special. You're special. And that's what I look at when I look at Christian. But, you know, like we said, he's also, he also is the perfect style running back for the age of, you know, that we're in the NFL. we'd be wrong if we put anybody else there than him until proven different. I just hope he can continue to stay upright, you know.
Well, an hour and 40 minutes later, Chris Connor, I think it's time to wrap it up. This was fun, man. Chris Connor, he's a bad, bad man. He's everywhere in the podcast world and decided to stop by today. Chris, you're the man. Appreciate you stopping by, man.
As always, man, anytime you need me, I'll ramble with you.
There you have it, Pels fans. If you liked today's episode, while you're here, if you're listening on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher, make sure to subscribe, leave a rate and review.
Do it!
That really, really helps us out more than you can even imagine. And if you're listening on a different platform, make sure to subscribe or follow so you can get notifications about the next episode is coming up. Also, go follow at Elliot Clough on Twitter, ELIOTCLOUGH, and you're going to find a plethora of Pelicans content over there. Go follow Believe on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, and you can check out a plethora of their other podcasts on Believe.com, or just head over to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, wherever you're listening to this podcast right here. And of course, you can check out some more Pelicans coverage on FanSided's Hoops Habit website. I finally put that article together like I promised. 5 reasons why the Pelicans will get the 8 or 9 seed going into the playoffs. And of course, you can always check out some work from myself, Chris Connor, former guests like Ollie Cosell and Preston Ellis, and David Grubb over on thebirdrights.com. And do not forget to go over to Twitter, give at Elliot Clough a follow. That's going to give you a bunch of opportunities to interact with us here on the show. So once again, I am Elliot Clough, and this was Believe in the New Orleans Pelicans.
Thank you for listening to Believe. You can show support to your host by subscribing to the show and giving us a 5-star rating on your preferred platform. Check us out at Believe.com and search for BLEAV on YouTube.